Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am Justice Lilia Puchinsky, and you're in the First Division of the First District of the Illinois Appellate Court. Today, we're hearing appeal number 121-0942. And normally on these Zooms, try to give everybody 10 or 15 minutes. Appellant reserves a couple of minutes for rebuttal. We may ask you some questions during that, but I assure you that we have read the record. We have read the briefs. We're familiar with the arguments. So we suggest always that you start with your best argument first and then work your way down if you have time. So with that in mind, if you could introduce yourselves, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Luke Casson for the appellant, Adriana Mazudis.
Thank you.
And good afternoon, Your Honors. Victor Pioli, P-I-O-L-I, here on behalf of the appellees, Lawrence Carlin, Warren Lupel, and the law firm of Lupel Weinuter.
Okay, that's great. Mr. Casson, please.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Luke Casson. I am counsel for the appellant, Adriana Mazudis. And we're before the court today to discuss the dismissal of Ms. Mazudis's first amended complaint in the trial court based on two principles, the section 603 for failure to concisely state a claim and 615. What I want to focus on with your honors today are just a few matters. I believe that the matters have been fully briefed adequately and are before your honors. The first and foremost is the standard of review. The parties appear to be at odds as to what the appropriate standard of review is. I want to discuss that just briefly and why that's important in this case. We believe that the appropriate standard of review is de novo. As we explain in our brief in some detail, why this particular case, but this category of cases generally should be reviewed by the reviewing courts as a de novo review versus an abuse of discretion review. I would concede with your honors that there are a number of cases that suggest that the appropriate 603 standard of review is a abuse of discretion. However, what those cases and other cases that address this issue clearly state is where the appellate court sits in as good a position as the trial court, there is no reason and no basis on which the appellate court or the reviewing court should cede its power of review to the statements or positions of the trial court. This is that case. Specifically, this court has before it is a complaint in which it sits in equal position. There was no testimony. There was no factual development. There's no discovery in this case. What we have is simply the complaint, the First Amendment complaint on which the court rendered its decision. Secondly, what this court has is the court's decision. The trial court issued a written ruling on both of these issues under 603 and under 615. There's no reasoned basis on which this court should defer to the trial court in determining the outcome of this case.
But is there a case that has adopted your suggestion that we use the de novo review under 603?
Yes, Your Honor. I've cited that case in my brief. The Schulte case addresses that specifically.
But most of the cases go the other way.
Most of the cases do. And one of the interesting thing about some of those cases, and I can't speak categorically to all of those cases, but one of the cases cited by the appellee in its brief is Cable America versus Pace. Now that's a little confusing as far as the application of the appropriate standard. In that case, specifically, the parties agreed to what the standard of review was. The court didn't find that the standard of review should have or even analyzed that it should be something else. But what Schulte does, and Schulte was decided after Cable America. In Schulte, those facts are much more on point to where we are today. And looking at those cases as a category, Your Honor, what we find is the simple principle of appellate review. If the court of review stands in the same position as the trial court, there is no reason to cede that authority to review. And it is a fresh review based on what was before the trial court. Here you have all of that information that the trial court had. There are other of those cases that find that the abuse of discretion standard. There were instances in those cases as a general category where the trial court was making a decision based on something that it had a particular, a unique access to, whether that's, and the Schulte case lays this out very nicely.
Okay, but I mean, Schulte, and then you cite General Motors, but beyond those two cases, the vast majority of cases through the decades say something different. And so you're asking us to follow the minority view, I guess.
I would.
And where would that stop? I mean, if that's the way we should do it, then I guess on everything that comes before us, when it's, we can make that kind of decision that we're in the same position to apply the law, that whatever standard may have been before, it always should be de novo.
It should be de novo, and that's precisely what we're asking. We're asking this court to not necessarily take.
But let me, I understand what you're asking. If we don't agree with you, do you lose?
I don't think we necessarily lose, but certainly.
But that's a question. Let's say you lose in that argument. All right, now where are you? That's my question.
Well, if we lose on that argument, then that makes the 603 analysis much different, because you are deferring to the trial court without the opportunity to analyze whether the trial court was correct in its decision.
No, okay, I understand. I mean, you're arguing the point. I'm just saying, let's assume. I'm not saying we decided. I don't know what my colleagues may say. And I'm not saying that I decided, but I'm trying to find out the other side of the coin. That is, this is your first argument, and Justice Breyer, give us one of your best arguments. And so it's very important to you that we use a de novo review on the 603, which is a major portion of the appeal. Okay, I understand that, okay. But what would happen if we don't do that? How does that affect you going forward on this case? That doesn't leave you much room, I assume. That's what you're saying.
That's precisely what I'm saying. And I think the example would be the lower court, the trial court, made a determination that there are four claims made in count one, or two claims made in count two, or okay, two other claims in count two. It seems overly deferential to say this court can't look at that and say the trial court was wrong.
Okay, so let me accept what you said. Let's look de novo at count, let's say two. Now, I look at the title of count two, and I've read your series of complaints, but this is the one that's up. It says legal malpractice regarding breach of fiduciary duties for conflicts of interest. Now, what is this count? Is it a legal malpractice count, or is it a breach of fiduciary count?
Well, excellent question, Your Honor. It is a legal malpractice count.
And
it very much so is.
And there's a difference between legal malpractice and breach of fiduciary duty. And you know that they're very different claims. And if you look back at that case law, you can't make those claims together. I mean, that's what the cases say.
That's what the cases say.
Yes. So you agree. So it's either, I mean, if it's a breach of fiduciary duty, that's a breach of fiduciary duty. You know, yeah, I mean, if it's a legal malpractice, it's a legal malpractice. And you're kind of in two and three, you're mushing them together. And then, you know, that's just the start. I'm trying to figure out, but you say it's regarding breach of fiduciary duties. Well, you don't need a legal malpractice. If it's a fiduciary duty, it could be separate. But it's all one and the same. So you're saying here it's one and the same? I'm not quite sure what you're saying and why you said it this way. I mean, you end request entry of an order that it says defendant's negligent malpractice is the sole and proximate cause of damages suffered. So that means your claim is legal malpractice. You're not talking about but you're talking about fiduciary duty. I don't understand why you combined them, I guess.
Okay. So let me address that why it's a single count and a single theory of recovery. We believe that the test is not the use of the words, but the claims made. I want to address one point that you just made, Your Honor. A breach of fiduciary duty count, a claim, a theory on which recovery can be sought is different than a legal malpractice. Now, where a legal malpractice claim and a breach of fiduciary duty claim are based on the same operative set of facts, they merge. That much is clear in the law. One can be dismissed outright, usually the breach of fiduciary duty claim. What's important in saying that alone, the breach of fiduciary duty, those acts that support a breach of fiduciary duty claim, which cannot exist in the environment of both a breach of fiduciary duty and a legal malpractice claim, can be the predicate acts for the legal malpractice. In fact, both Hull and Rice, they elucidate this quite well. Is that there are where there are multiple acts of malpractice, those can form a single theory of legal malpractice. Now, when speaking of a breach of fiduciary duty or a fiduciary duty period, the court has said a breach of fiduciary duty is in and of itself an act of malpractice. Specifically, Metric suggests that all breaches of fiduciary duty is malpractice. So they're not exclusive of one another. And the appellees, and quite frankly, the trial court simply adopted this without analysis about what those breaches or what those claims were and what the theory of liability was. Now, there is a theory of liability for each of counts one, two, and three, all coming under a claim of legal malpractice. They generate from different series of acts, but the series of acts do not foreclose a plaintiff from bringing that claim. That much is absolutely clear in the jurisprudence in this area.
So I just to make sure I understand. Those claims then are all legal malpractice claims.
They are
underlying facts, like in count two, have to do with conflicts of interest.
Correct.
Okay, so the next problem would be where are the facts that set forth the legal malpractice claim here? It seems that you have a lot of conclusions, but where are the facts? And particularly considering that you've already had discovery, in summary judgment in the earlier case. So it's very, I'm trying to figure out what happened. Explain count two to me. I mean, tell me and succinctly tell me what this claim is about.
Count two is relates to a legal malpractice by the defendants, the appellees, wherein they took actions outside of the conduct of litigation that damaged the plaintiff. That's as succinctly as
okay.
I can
okay.
say.
Okay, so actions, all right, now what actions did they take specifically? Because when I read this again, here, I'm just picking the paragraphs, 76. In January 2011, the plaintiff informed defendant Carlin that Mr. Michael was not to receive any information about the Polecats litigation. There is no inform how he was informed, when. I mean, it's just January, it's a long time. Was it orally, in writing? What was it, to receive any information? You know, what is any information about? I don't know what that means. I'm trying to figure out what this is all about.
Well, that is what it's all about. They received information provided by the defendants that they were specifically told not to provide.
Okay, what information is that?
Information relating to the litigation, specifically relating to her taxes, her financial condition, which is all laid out in the complaint.
Is that the Polecats litigation? Is that some other litigation?
That's the Polecats litigation.
And the Michaels were not involved in the Polecats litigation?
The Michaels were not parties to the litigation. I can't say that they weren't involved, because that's the sine qua non of our discussion here today, is why they were so involved and why Mr. Carl and Mr. Lupel brought them in the manner in which they did without being parties.
So
and how they were paid by them and how they were served.
How they were served. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's our theory, as laid out in the complaint, that Robert Michael and George Michael, specifically George Michael, his interests were the ones that were being served, not Miss Mizutis's. Is that they set up a this is outside of the litigation, had nothing to do with the litigation. They set up a corporation. They set up or prepared a liquor license application.
When you say they, you're talking about the defendants.
We're talking about the defendants.
Okay. Now, where does it say here that they set up, you know, this liquor license and this corporation? Where is that in the count two?
My apologies, Your Honor. That's in count one. So in count two, relating to the fiduciary duties and conflict of interest, your question is specific to count two?
Yes.
All right. So the
in the conflicts of interest, you're saying, you know, so and you don't incorporate one into two. So it's just the first 17 paragraphs. So count two has nothing to do with what you just told me.
Right. So that's count one.
What's count two about?
My apologies. Count two is specifically about his representation of Ms. Tamuzian and Mr. Michael in litigation against my client, against Ms. Mazzutis.
Where am I supposed to figure that out? What litigation? What litigation is that? Is that the
paragraph 68?
Polecat's litigation.
No, that's not Polecat's litigation. That was a claim that he brought, Mr. Carlin specifically, for Mr. On behalf of Mr. Michael, brought as a first he tried to intervene on his behalf, and then there was a subsequent filing that ultimately ended up with Judge Novak, but was a separate case. Mr. Michael was suing Ms. Mazzutis.
Wait, you're telling us she, the date she fired them was what date?
That was February, I believe it was February 4th of 2011.
February 4th of 2011. And they represented her before that. And you're saying here in paragraph 68, that after that, the same lawyers sued their immediately former client representing the Michaels?
That's what happened.
Okay. And, so that's paragraph 69. Says it alleged identical claims as the plaintiff claims against the club. Except that Michael was asserting that he had a right to control and ownership of the club and that Michael had obtained the plaintiff's rights during the defendant's representation of the plaintiff. All right. So are you saying this is a violation? You're saying he can't represent the Michaels against them, her? Is that part of this claim?
That is.
Okay, that's what you're trying to say here?
That's correct.
All right.
Back to your comment about, I'm sorry, just Simon.
No, go ahead.
You had mentioned a liquor license fact. And I'm sorry, I can't find that. Where is that in this complaint?
Bear with me one moment, Your Honor.
I thought you said it was in count one, but you could just direct my attention to it. I don't want to take up all of your time.
I apologize. I should have this at the ready. And
well, maybe I do that on rebuttal. But let me ask another question. With regard to the Temuzian suit, Temuzian was involved in the Polkitz case, right?
Temuzian was not involved in the Polkitz case.
So Carlin never represented or never opposed Temuzian?
He represented Temuzian.
He represented Temuzian. He filed a lawsuit for it. I understand that. But that, does that have any, what's that have to do with your client?
Because that was making the, that was a client or a person who was making the same claim that that Ms. Mazzutis had. They were adverse claims.
Well, you're saying, where do you say that the adverse claims and where, and how are they adverse and where is that pled?
In count two, Your Honor. Paragraph 72. 78.
Well, but I mean, claiming a right of ownership, filed an action, you describe the action. I mean, the defendants represented others and clearly adverse interest. I mean, aren't those conclusions? You know, saying clearly adverse interests is a conclusion. I mean, I'm trying to figure out a lot of this seems to be conclusions. So my question to you is, what do you contend is the difference between factual allegations and conclusory allegations? How do I read this complaint? I mean, when you say on February 9th, 2019, 2012, the Temuzian action was voluntarily dismissed. That's factual, okay? To say that there was, the defendants represented others with clearly adverse interests, that's a conclusion.
Well, in paragraph 82, Carlin filed on October 18th, 2011, Carlin filed an action on behalf of Susan Temuzian claiming a right of ownership in Polkatz, which directly diminished the value of the plaintiff's ownership.
But that's a conclusion. I mean, you already did. Paragraph 72 and paragraph 82 both have to do with the same complaint, right? So you mentioned it twice. And I'm just, in ownership of 1 million, I mean, we don't have a copy of that as part of this. How do I know that? I mean, what are the facts that say that that created that conflict? I mean, sometimes lawyers can represent parties who are both defendants in the same matter or have similar interests.
Not requesting the exact same thing. This is what count two lays out in the prefatory facts. Are the underlying litigation brought by Mr. Carlin and Mr. Lupel were that Ms. Mazzutis owned the equitable rights in the club. Then they bring a claim on behalf of Temuzian after the fact, after they were terminated, claiming that Temuzian had a right to the club.
You allege in your complaint that whatever the basis of that lawsuit was, it was dismissed.
The claim was dismissed.
So how then is your client damaged?
Well, that is more of a question of fact. How specifically they were damaged was they reduced the value of the club by $1 million.
How's that?
What is that based on?
Based on the valuation of the club.
But where do you plead that? I mean, you say $1 million. I see the $1 million, okay? To me, it just comes out, you could have said 3 million. I don't know. Where's the description? Where are the facts to say the $1 million, that you're damaged by $1 million?
Well, I guess.
What do you base that on? I'm asking you, what is it based
on? It's based on evaluation from an evaluator of the property.
Which is not here, which is not talked about with valuation of the property and when it happened. I mean, those are facts that would show damages. But to say I was damaged by $1 million is a conclusion. I was damaged by $1 million. How was I damaged? Those are facts, okay? I was damaged because somebody else filed a lawsuit. Whatever it is, I don't know. And then there was an expert came in and did this evaluation, and there's a judgment or something, or a settlement, and I lost, you know. But you have none of that.
So the catch-22 of the situation is, if I plead that there is an evaluation of the club done, and that club or that evaluator concluded that the valuation was diminished by $1 million, that's a conclusion too.
A lot of things are, you know, almost every fact is could be considered a conclusion. Okay, it depends. It's a very close, you know, what is a fact, what is a conclusion? The United States Supreme Court hasn't even figured that one out yet. If you read the, if you know the Tui and those cases, it's very confused. So we're not going to be able to figure that one out here. But we do know that if you don't have those things, it is a conclusion. Just to say the one statement without more doesn't give us any idea how you got there and that you were damaged. I mean, you know, how do we know this? I mean, well, how do they know? How do they respond? I'm damaged by $1 million. I mean, that's a conclusion.
But Your Honor, this is again the catch 22. If they answer and they say, I can't answer that because I don't know what the whether that's conclusory, and I say, well, okay, wait a minute. I will tell you that we have expert X that says that there's a diminishment of the value of the club because of the filing of the Tamusian matter by $1 million. And then there's an objection, and then there's a motion on it saying it's conclusory. Those aren't facts.
You're saying it was
so we don't get anywhere.
You're saying it was an undisclosed expert. I mean, you had done this in connection with your lawsuit or with another lawsuit. I mean, I'm not clear where this expert came from or who he is or she.
But how are those facts?
Okay, but you would agree though that just saying $1 million, I want $1 million. When you have to show actual damages.
Yes.
Okay, but just saying $1 million is a conclusion. And we have to, one of the criteria for you to get past 615 is actual damages. Otherwise, you don't get past goal. So how are we supposed to consider this in light of that?
Well, for instance, Your Honor, this wasn't decided on 615. This was decided on a 603. So that's a different question entirely.
Well, it's the same thing because, I mean, 613 doesn't state a claim. Under 603, they're saying we can't figure out what claim you're even trying to make, okay? Because it's not clear, plain, so forth, which is what the court instructed. And what we have here is instead of, and the first time around, you had both times you have six counts. Now you have 33 pages of 177 paragraphs. Last time it was 39 pages of 157 paragraphs. But a lot of those paragraphs are the exact same paragraphs with subparts and everything else. I read the complaint and the other complaints, and I still am not clear on what you're trying to plead. I'm just saying that, in any other way, it is difficult to follow this and figure out what's going on, particularly when you get into those large paragraphs with lots of subparts that like say a lot of conclusory things and where this is all coming from. She said here, paragraph 56, suffered damages in the following particular, the loss of diminished value of interest in the club. How did that happen? The loss of business interest. How did what they did equal loss of business interest in Vaunch and Polecats? How did what they did create the loss of life insurance proceeds paid to her due to the death of her husband? I mean, where is the facts that would tell us that? And then we have this second lawsuit and the first lawsuit. I mean, it's really hard.
Can I add something to that? Where are the facts? You talk about her losing her home and $1 million. Where are the facts that support that? Where are the facts that support that all this money is allegedly being taken out of her bank accounts?
Well, that's quite, again, we get into the same roundabout discussion on what equates the fact and what equates a conclusion.
The difference is, by my count, you've had 7 tries at this and you've done discovery. So this is not a situation where you're on your second complaint in a cause of action.
I agree that is the status of the complaint.
Is there anything else that you want to?
No, I'm quite a bit over my time. So I would, that is all the appellant has at this point.
I just have one random question. In paragraph 110, you talk about Patrick Splann. Who's Patrick Splann?
Patrick Splann is her, Ms. Mazudis' former boyfriend. And he, information was provided to him by the defendants, by the appellees, about the litigation.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Kasson? Okay, Mr. Pioli, please.
Hey, please, the court, counsel. Once again, Victor Pioli on behalf of the appellees, Lawrence Carlin, Warren Lapel, and the law firm of Lapel Weininger. Your honors, this is a case which has simply run its course. After 10 years and 7 attempts, with the benefit of written discovery, oral discovery, and expert discovery, plaintiff is still not able to plead a viable complaint complying with the Illinois rules of practice and civil procedure. In particular, plaintiff's complaints run afoul of section 2-603 of the Code of Civil Procedure, which provides that each separate cause of action upon which a separate recovery might be had shall be stated in a separate count. This case was before this court in 2019, after the trial court had granted our defendant's motion.
Yeah, is that anything we don't already know? What about the fact that we're told that counts 2 and 3 are legal malpractice counts? They're not fiduciary breach of fiduciary duty counts. Doesn't that clear things up?
I don't believe it does, Judge. And the reason why it doesn't is, one, they're labeled as legal malpractice and breach of fiduciary duty counts, and
they're not. It said legal malpractice regarding breach of fiduciary duties. So just clarify it. It's a legal malpractice count, and it ends as a legal. It says at the end, negligence of malpractice. So, based upon breaches of fiduciary duty, they're making a legal malpractice claim. So that's one count. Why? Where's the other counts in there?
You can allege what the case law holds is that you can allege the same conduct that can form a legal malpractice and a breach of fiduciary duty separate count. There is no case law which says that you can combine the two. And the reason why count 2 is deficient, Your Honor, is because if you look at count 2, it alleges a breach of fiduciary duty based on alleged conflict of interest. Well, part of the problem is that that was already alleged in count 1. And in particular, if you look at paragraphs 49, D, E, F, and G, those allege breach of fiduciary duty with regard to alleged conflict of interest. So we have counts different counts being alleged in count one and count two, you just can't commingle all your causes of action into different claims. So it's completely improper.
Which subparts of 49 are you talking about?
49 D, E, F, and G.
Okay, so you're saying that they're making the same claims in two that they basically say in one. But even at 49, are those facts in your opinion, or are those conclusions?
It's tough for me to tell sometimes with this complaint, Judge. But I interpret them as facts. I mean, they're conclusory facts. Let's put it that way. They conclude that they allege that my clients elevated the interests of the Michael brothers over those of the plaintiff. It's a conclusory fact, but it's one that's ultimately not supported either. And we're going to get to that when we talk about the 2615 aspect of the motion. Before I delve into that, though, I do want to kind of streamline things. I want to touch upon a couple of the arguments that Mr. Kaysen raised. The first being the standard of review. As we put forth in our brief on a 2-603 appellate review, the standard is for an abuse of discretion. The case is cited by Mr. Kaysen, the Schulte case out of the Fourth District, that did not involve a 2-603 motion. It involved a 1203 motion for reconsideration. So it's completely inapplicable. All the case law, and in particular, Justice Hyman, you'll see the case that we attached to our brief, the case that you authored, Anderson versus Lachinsky, it clearly states that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. So I don't think there's any dispute about that. Couple of other things that Mr. Kaysen touched upon. Justice Hyman, you questioned Mr. Kaysen about paragraph 68 and this filing of a, alleged filing of another claim by my clients on behalf of Mr. Michael against the plaintiff. Judge, we're at this point where we completed discovery. We've gone through this for 10 years now. That is a completely false allegation. And we went ahead and we mentioned it in our appellee's brief. Mr. Michael was represented by an attorney, Richard Zachary, in that case. Mr. Carlin did not represent Mr. Michael in that case. It's just a false allegation. Not to mention the fact, if the claim isn't sufficiently fleshed out, it could, if you represent it.
What you're saying is extremely important because there may have been a false statement made before a court, which should be reported to the authorities if that's what had happened here. Because you're saying that when they allege that defendants filed an appearance for George Michael against plaintiff in that case before Judge Novick, are you saying that that is false? That is, it's either true or it's false.
That is not true.
It's totally not true. Absolutely untrue.
Untrue.
Untrue. Okay. So
Attorney Zachary that filed the appearance on behalf of Mr. Michael.
And but did they ever file? So the defendants appeared. Did they ever file an appearance? Even
no.
if it was later. I mean, they had nothing to do with that suit. Is that, what, it's somebody, that is something that can be checked, right? I mean,
that can be checked. It's in the court file.
Yeah. And there's a rule about making allegations that are untrue. Was that brought before the judge in this case? No.
If you're asking, did I file a Rule 137 motion? I did not.
Okay.
And, not the disclosed strategy, Judge, but I guess I was happy with the dismissal at that point. I did not file a sanctions motion.
But they're making the same. I mean, there's been so much I've read. I'm asking you, though, if you can recall that they made that allegation separately before us, or if it's in the complaint, should have been brought below. But if they're regurgitating it in the brief before us, then that might be something separate.
I agree with you, Judge. And I think there's also, under the rules of professional conduct, I think there's a duty. If you're aware of a false statement, you have a duty to then go and correct it. And that's under Rule 3.3, duty of candor to the tribunal. So I do think that there was a potential violation with that statement.
Okay. Are there any other statements here that were false?
You know, I'd have to go through the complaint again, Judge. And, you know, there were things that were brought out in discovery. Like I said, we did go through 7 years of discovery in this case. And there were many things that were proven to be false, particularly when, you know, there was an allegation that Mr. Carlin stole money out of the plaintiff's bank account. That clearly did not happen. The money was transferred out of her account voluntarily. And, you know, there was an allegation that her signature was forged on the documents concerning Mr. Michael. It was admitted in her deposition that she didn't forge that document. So there are all kinds of things like that that are littered throughout this complaint that, yes, were false. And I think, you know, if I remember correctly, because I didn't prepare the summary judgment hearing, but I think we highlighted many of those things in our summary judgment briefing back when we were before the court in 2019. And still those allegations made their way into this complaint as well. Turning to, and Justice Coghlan, you stole a little bit of my thunder on the Timuzian case with regard to that allegation. Yes, in paragraph 83, it was alleged that it was voluntarily dismissed. What you did not see in the complaint, and also a fact that came out, that the suit by George Michael against Ms. Mazudis was also dismissed. So there can't be any damages that were sustained by Ms. Mazudis as a result of the filing of that lawsuit, even if Mr. Carlin was the one who filed it, which he was not.
Well, along those same lines, you know, this summary judgment complaint that they're complaining about, that was dismissed too, right?
The summary judgment?
Summary judgment motion that they, they're complaining about a summary judgment motion being filed, I think, against the plaintiff, but wasn't that ultimately?
She won the summary judgment motion, correct.
I'm sorry, you're much more articulate than I am, but.
It's late in the day, Justice.
That's a great compliment, mind you.
Justice Coghlan, you also mentioned something about the liquor license. I just want to be complete candor with the court. That is actually alleged in paragraph 153. Which is in count six, not count two, as counsel had indicated. And that's count six is a breach of contract count. I don't understand how applying for the liquor license constituted a breach of the agreement between the parties. But as we put in our brief, count six is just a hodgepodge, just throwing together of all the previous allegations and throwing it into a breach of contract count, which is obviously improper.
That allegation pertains to Aerocat PK LLC.
Correct. That was the LLC that applied for the liquor license.
But what relation does that have to this litigation?
I don't think it does. Mr. Carlin and Mr. LaPelle had formed that entity and they applied for a liquor license. Nothing ever came of it. Nothing ever happened with it. So I don't know why it's
connection somehow to Polkits.
I don't believe so. No.
And that's not alleged anywhere.
No, it's not. And like I said, nothing ever happened with it. I believe as Mr. LaPelle and Mr. Carlin both testified in their depositions. So it's just another, like I said, just, you know, throwing an allegation against the wall and see if it sticks. But there's just nothing to it, which is the problem with a lot of these claims. I'm not going to go ahead and go through the specific, it's because it sounds like from your questioning, you've actually gone through all the new counts in the most recent complaint. So I'm not going to waste your time and go through them and highlight why they were violative of 2603. I think it's readily apparent on the face of it. So with that, I just want to touch a little bit on the 615 aspects of the motion. And Justice Hyman, you asked Mr. Kaysen, you know, he alleges that there was certain information that was disclosed to other parties. A big problem we've had since this is going back to 2013, when this case, 2012, when this case was instituted, we filed motions to dismiss asking, what is this information? And, you know, we did it during discovery. I asked Ms. Mazudis during her deposition, what is this alleged information that was disclosed? And I've never gotten an answer. I've been sitting here for 10 years trying to get an answer to these questions, and I've just never gotten them. And once again, this complaint is filed and it doesn't allege what this information is or how its disclosure allegedly harmed Ms. Mazudis. So, you know, the 615 deficiencies in the complaint are evident. Even if the court didn't, the trial court didn't dismiss on 2-603 grounds, there were certainly ample grounds to dismiss on 2-615. So with that, like I said, I'm not going to take up any more of the court's time because it sounds like you have a pretty good handle on what was alleged and not alleged in the complaint. But if your honors have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Kaysen, to rebut, wrap it up.
We have no further rebuttal. I think we've covered the points we were intending to cover.
All right, I'll ask my colleagues one more time. Any other questions? Hearing none, I want to thank you both for your very solid oral arguments on behalf of your clients and the briefing that was done. This is obviously a complex case with a lot of layers. We are aware of that. We've read everything. We've read the complaints, read the record, read the briefs. And at this time, we'll take this matter under advisement, and this court is adjourned.